Blair.com.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. Compassionate conservatism, it turns out, is more than a bumper sticker. It is presented now as a political philosophy in George W. Bush's Washington. It starts out by blaming liberalism for most of America's social ills, from teen pregnancy to violent crime to the decline of public schools and moral standards. It's not the economy, stupid, they say. It's the culture. The culture of permissiveness, the culture of arrogance that supposes you can feed the body without nourishing the soul, and most of all, the cultural philosophy of blaming the system and convincing the poor that they're victims. Compassionate conservatism ends with the promise that God will save us, not social policy. Our guests this hour wrote the book on compassionate conservatism. Marvin Alasky and Myron Magnet are the big thinkers behind George W. Bush's campaign slogan. Marvin Alasky is a journalism professor at the University of Texas. Myron Magnet edits the City Journal for the conservative think tank, the Manhattan Institute. Connection listeners, do you get it? Compassionate conservatism. Do you recognize compassion here? How about conservatism? Is it Reaganism revisited? Is it Newt Gingrich's Contract with America or Bill Bennett's Book of Virtues? Or is it, as the London Guardian called it, Thatcherism plus God? 1-800-423-8255 makes the connection, or 1-800-423-TALK, the compassionate conservative connection this hour. Welcome, Marvin Alasky and Myron Magnet. Marvin Alasky, would you walk us through the big ideas here? Define compassionate conservatism for us.
Well, there are about three parts to it. Number one, it is a way to provide effective help to those in need, particularly those who are poor, also those who are long-term alcoholics or addicts or have a whole variety of social problems. This is the mechanism, in a sense, that works because it's based on the understanding of compassion is actually suffering with. That's the literal meaning of the word, suffering with those in need. So it's an emphasis on person-to-person help. Number two, it's part of a way to restore civil society. I think President Bush talks about the need for us to be, once again, citizens rather than spectators. Civil society, that is all the mediating institutions between government and the individual, smaller than government, bigger than the individual, the way to help individuals in need without having to grow government even larger and create more of the bureaucracy that many of us have come to see is not particularly effective. And then third, it's a way to bring back churches and synagogues and mosques into participation in these programs. For the past 40 years, we've had a tendency to try to ban God from all kinds of public buildings and public programs, and the result has been not neutrality, but nakedness. Richard John Newhouse talks about the naked public square. This is an attempt to put on some clothes.
Myron Magnet, do you want to add a hat or a cape or whatever to that description?
Yes, Chris, I would like to. I'd like to put in a couple of negatives here. What compassionate conservatism is not. It's an enormous challenge to liberals because it says that conservatives properly do care about the poor, something that Republicans have not brought front and center for quite some time now. But what it does is it rejects all of those things that that liberals tried over the last 35 years or more, and which compassionate conservatism says these just didn't work. Look, we tried the whole nine yards of liberal solutions for helping the poor. We tried a generous welfare policy. We tried a lenient criminal justice policies. We tried self-esteem-centered education. And it just didn't work because even as the economy went shooting ahead over decades now, we ended up with an underclass, a group of very poor, mostly minority people, mostly in inner cities, who remained in poverty for their whole lives and even seemed to give poverty as an inheritance to their children and grandchildren. So what we're saying is, okay, we tried that, it didn't work, we did the experiment. Now we need to emphasize a whole sense of a whole set of other things. And I would say, first of all, personal responsibility. education that provides people with the cognitive and moral tools that they need to get through life and be successful, safe neighborhoods, and tax policies that, when you finally make it into the bottom reaches of the middle class, allow you to keep yourselves there. Now, I agree with Marvin Olasky on the importance of religion, but rather than putting it, rather than giving it such a huge presence in compassionate conservatism, I think what I would say is that all those people who will need help, even in a responsibility society, many of them have problems that really are inner problems. They're problems of the spirit, problems of their worldview or values or attitudes. And so simply to give them money and say, here, this solves your problem, is missing something that's key about what they need. They need to change their lives around. And Marvin can speak much better than I can about this.
Okay, can I just...
About how religion works.
Throw here. In a general line here. I mean, we're used to politicians claiming credit for the sunrise, and we're actually going to give you a lot of slack here. These are new ideas, and we want to hear them. But I have to qualify a couple of things. I mean, not to argue every point, but you talk about a lenient crime policy. We've got more people locked up in this country than in any comparable democracy. Nobody's gotten rich that I know on this, what you call a very generous welfare system. The whole matter of personal responsibility, if anything, was the theme of the Clinton years, and he did change welfare as we know it. So I want you to be kind of precise on just what you're claiming here and what you're claiming as new. What's different? Well, could I just go back one step? I mean, I want to just sort of keep a reality check here. What is new and different about compassionate conservatism compared, say, to traditional Republican doctrine? Reagan Republican doctrine, Gingrich Republican doctrine. Marvin Olasky.
Number of things. I mean, number one, we've tended to have a battle in the society between the individualism that the Republican Party has held up and basically the collective approaches that the Democratic Party has been putting forward. This approach, compassionate conservatism, could be called an associationist approach. That is, it's not collective in the sense of looking to big government. It is looking to have society in various ways involved in these problems. And the best way to do it, I think, is what has been historical in America ever since Alexis de Tocqueville in the 1830s, the involvement of associations. That is, groups that people voluntarily join for social purposes of various kinds that allow you to put the community to work without growing government. I mean, that's a different approach than either the collectivism or the individualism of the past.
Do you want to embellish that, Myron Magnet? I mean, again, putting it in a kind of historical framework?
Well, I think that I'd like to pick up on something that Marvin says. There is a much greater emphasis on the individual than what the Democrats and the liberals have placed. And I think that at the center of compassionate conservatism is a different psychology. There is the notion that if you treat people as the passive recipients of aid, of government largesse, you treat them as being less fully human than you are. You assume that all you have to do is take care of the outer man or woman, and you're all set. But, of course, what happens is that people begin to feel as if they are not the protagonists of their own life when they're put in this situation. They come to feel as if they are just the passive playthings of vast forces that determine their fate. And so when you have real economic and social opportunity, you find that there are people who have difficulty taking advantage of it because everything in the culture has been saying, you're a victim, you're passive, you need the government to do this for you.
Remind us of, you know, concretely how the society says that to people.
A couple of days, and again, it's just a minor experience I had, but I've gone around at times as I dressed as a homeless guy, and at various homeless feeding stations, particularly in Washington, D.C., I wasn't asked ever to do anything, even busing my tray the way you do at McDonald's or Burger King. That is, you come in, you sit down, food's put in front of you, you eat, you can ask for seconds if you want or thirds, then you just get up and walk away. No effort of any kind whatsoever. It's very kind. It's the way I feed my dogs. Put some food in their bowl, put some water in, scratch them on the head, and let them lie around all day. But that's not the way we should treat. We should treat people created in God's image, capable of doing wonderful things.
And, you know, if you look at what the result of welfare reform has been, you can get some sense of what this difference is that we're talking about. We have a lot of anecdotal information that women who have been long-term welfare users who now get out into the workforce really do feel now as if they are empowered in some way. We've been talking in the, you know, in the pre-reform welfare era as if work were a kind of punishment. But, you know, the fact of the matter is it is the human condition to work, and all of us like to work, and the work ethic really is an ethic, as the Victorians who wrote about it conceived of it. It was that thing in which you grab a hold of the world and try to exert your own personality on it, and by so doing you can find out what you're capable of doing, and you get a sense of accomplishment, of mastery, of self-esteem, to use the jargon.
I grant you that, and I think we'd all agree with that. I get it every day.
And
I'm grateful. But at the same time, this is also the fruit of, if I may say, the Clinton economy and a 3% unemployment rate. There have been lots and lots of times in the industrial economy and the last Bush administration when jobs were hard to find and people had to eat. I want you to detail. I mean, first of all, this is a very easy doctrine for good times, extremely
good
times.
Chris, remember that the underclass came into existence in the mid-60s when the Kennedy tax cuts made
the poor have always been with us, and they always will, don't we believe?
We do believe that, and I leave Marvin to talk about that.
There was that fellow who told us that a long time ago.
That's it.
But not any particular poor. The genius of American society and the American economy was moving people out of poverty. My grandparents all came into Boston right before World War I. They were extremely poor. They worked hard. They became middle class. The same thing has happened to tens of millions of immigrants over the years. The problem comes when you don't have that movement, when people get when it gets frozen in and people are stuck there in a perpetual winter where it's always winter and never Christmas.
But the problem is also when the economy turns down, and it always does, and then that first word in there, compassion, is tested. I the question I want to come back to, I mean, I hear the conservatism in your doctrine. When we come back, I want to hear the nature of this compassion and beyond sort of letting people you know, learn their lessons through suffering, or learn how to, you know, sell apples in a depressed economy. We'll come back to it. Myron Magnet and Marvin Olasky are our guests. They are the inventors, in a fashion, of compassionate conservatism. They're the gurus who gave the idea to George W. Bush for his campaign, and now it turns out for his presidency. We'll be back. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by words
who invented it, Myron Magnet in New York, Marvin Olasky in Austin, Texas. We hear the conservative side. Marvin Olasky, what's the content of compassion here?
The problems we've had with the governmental welfare system has been that even the most humane, most thoughtful, most concerned social worker with a caseload of 1 to 200 or if lowered to 1 to 100 or 1 to 50 still can't spend that person-to-person time with the individual that's often needed. I mean, as Myron said, and he's hit this, I think very well, there are some individuals on poverty who are in there without any need for attitudinal adjustment. I mean, there are people who are laid off. There are
attitudinal
people,
adjustment sounds like re-education in China.
Well, it also sounds like a different way of looking at things. And if I can finish here, the problem often is not external. Sometimes it is, as I was saying. Sometimes people are laid off of jobs and so forth, no fault of their own, if you want to use that term, and I will. Other times there is fault, in the sense of people have thoroughly messed up their lives for a whole lot of reasons. Sometimes it's because they've had a terrible education, and one of the structural problems we have in the society is lots of inner-city schools that are absolutely horrendous. That needs to be changed. People need to have some opportunity to get better schools. But still, a lot of people are in bad shape. And it's not just that a job is going to make them healthy. It's not just that a paycheck is going to make them healthy. There are some real fundamental problems, which, in fact, require changes of attitude. Now, how do those come about? They don't come about just by reporting to the government office once a week or having a social worker have you on his list of things to do. What normally happens is that there has to be someone who is going to work with that person intensely and be with that person. Mm. Someone who's going to be there when, you look at the plight of many single moms in our society with kids and no backup, when she's trying to get a job and the kids get sick or the car breaks down. And all sorts of problems emerge. You need to have someone who is there who really cares about that person. And a government official is just not, even the most caring, they're not going to be able to do it. They just don't have the time. The pros don't have the time to put in one-to-one.
Marvin Olesky, stand by. I want to introduce David Brooks into the conversation. David Brooks, senior editor of the Weekly Standard, author of Bobos in Paradise, which married bohemians and bourgeois. David, can you marry compassion and conservatism? Are you a convert?
Yeah, I don't know if I'm a convert. I'm still Jewish. One of the things that I think where I do differ with Marvin and Myron is I think it's a little less transformational than they're describing it. We've had, since Bill Clinton campaigned in 92, at least greater talk about welfare, about responsibility. Clinton campaigned on welfare reform, and there has grown up this whole new democratic tradition of being emphasizing responsibility. John DiIulio himself, who is heading Bush's faith and community effort, calls himself a new Democrat. When he was asked to go to Austin to visit with George W. Bush, he didn't return 12 calls because he says, "I don't hang with Republicans." So I don't think it's a radical break from some parts of the Democratic mantra. The second grand thing, and I think this is also a slow
evolution. Are you saying it's a bigger change for Republicans than for the country?
Well, I think it is a change for Republicans. It's certainly a walk away from the idea that government shouldn't get involved in any way. Sort of a pure libertarian or laissez-faire effort. It's certainly a walk away from that. But it's also a change, and I think this is the most important, in our public acceptance of religion, which Clinton had something to do with, Al Gore had something to do with, Joe Lieberman had something to do
Jimmy
with.
Jimmy Carter had something to do
Jimmy
with.
Jimmy Carter as well. You know, there was a great story when George Bush the Elder ran for president in 1988. He was asked what he was thinking about when his plane was shot down in the Pacific, and he said, "Well, I was thinking of my family and God, and the separation of church and state." And what obviously happened in his brain was he said God and he said, "Oh, I can't say God." So then he said separation of church and state, as if that's what he was really thinking about in the Pacific. But George Bush the Younger is much more comfortable about talking about God and much more comfortable about talking about the way faith in God and the religious transformation can transform a life. And I think the Bush people are going into this in a very hard-headed manner, saying there's some evidence that, especially in drug treatment programs and other ways, that these programs, these faith-based programs, really do work better. But on the other hand, we have to be concerned about the religion being washed out of them. We have to be concerned about discrimination and other issues. I've really been quite impressed by the way DiIulio is really approaching this in a very hard-headed, cautious manner.
What does hard-headed mean in this case? What do you mean by hard-headed?
Well, DiIulio says quite up front, you know, there hasn't been the kind of research into a lot of these programs that there has in federal government programs. So we're not totally sure what works, and we're going to test it out because the early indications is there is some evidence. The second thing, and this worries people like me quite a lot, you know, these are religious institutions. How how strong can you really get the federal government in there before they become less religious institutions? When these ideas bubbled up about 3 or 4 years ago by Indiana Senator Dan Coats, he didn't really have as much emphasis on federal grants into these faith-based organizations. He had tax credits. And that seemed to me a cleaner way to preserve the independence of these organizations than the Bush way. And that has to raise some concerns.
We're backing into the sort of faith-based initiative. I want to stick with compassionate conservatism. Is there a coherent idea here, in your view, David Brooks?
Yeah, I think the idea is that scarcity is not the problem in many cases, that it really takes a spiritual transformation. It takes a more intense and more personal and humanistic concern that the people who are now having drug problems or any other problems are not just part of a mass proletariat, but they are individuals with individual needs which have to be handled on an individual basis.
Hmm. Myron Magnett is the author, I should have said, of a book called The Dream and the Nightmare about the 60s and the underclass. Myron Magnett, do you want to leap back in?
Yes, indeed, I do.
Welcome back.
Thanks. It's a pleasure. I think that what is new here is that compassionate conservatives mean their personal spark part of the equation. That is, it's certainly true, as David Brooks says, and as you, Chris, have suggested, that these ideas have been in the air for a number of years. Certainly the New Democrats have been talking the talk. It is true that Bill Clinton signed the Welfare Reform Act of 1996 after vetoing it twice, of course. But, you know, even though social workers now say to wife beaters, you really have to stop this, you're doing wrong. And even though they say to drug users, you really have to stop this, it's ruining your life. If you say at the same time that you're the victim of your environment, that we have to focus on the bad things that were done to you, the message isn't really powerful. The message is, as it were, ancillary to the larger message, which is you're not really responsible here. Yeah, you ought to take responsibility, but first we have to transform society so that you no longer are this victimized person who's just acting out what has been done to you. And I think that although that is a kind of subtle shift, it's conclusive for the people whom social services are trying to help.
Hmm. David Brooks, I know we got to let you go, but I wonder if you can just sort of fit this into a Brooksian kind of grand scheme of of social theory as American politicians sort of adopt them. I mean, there are elements of 12-step and of Gingrich and of old Republicans and new Republicans, a little bit of Clinton, too. I mean, put it in context.
You're looking for me to be a big blowhard. I think what it is, it's first of all, a concession by Republicans that the government can't get out of the way. And George Bush is quite explicit about the idea that doesn't replace many of the welfare plans we have. It supplements them and it transforms them. It's an idea, I think, in a larger scheme that religion is becoming a more acceptable tool in the public square, that a lot of Democrats and most Republicans are now much more comfortable talking about religion and using the power of religion. At the same time, as I say, being concerned that religion will be corrupted by being so used in a political fashion in this way.
David Brooks, thank you, as always.
Thank you.
David Brooks of the Weekly Standard and the bestseller Bobos in Paradise, 1-800-423-8255, joins the conversation on compassionate conservatism, the doctrine, the philosophy, maybe, of the Bush administration. Debbie is on the line.
Hi. You know, I haven't really heard from a compassionate Republican yet what compassionate conservatism really is. I've heard people have personal epiphanies, and now they can talk about religion. But I think when it was first mentioned, most people thought that we were going to have a George Bush government, which was fiscally conservative as we know it, but with a focus that they, too, were compassionate and cared about human problems. We're going to use a government for social programs in their own way. And all I hear is that, well, now it's okay to talk about religion. People are comfortable with religion. Now, of course, I think faith-based groups work because they're groups that care and work like mentoring one-on-one with people. Any group that does that well will work, faith-based or not. I don't really know what compassionate conservatism is yet after all this time.
Marvin Alasky or Myron Magnet, take one more crack at Debbie.
So well, Myron, do you want to do it?
Well, I just want to get at one thing that that Debbie was talking about. No, Marvin, I think I'll put it over to you.
Okay. All right, a couple of things. Number one, there is a movement away from government bureaucracy here. This is not saying that government doesn't have a role to play. It does. But in the 1960s, we said basically the government has the role to play. The government is the central entity here. This is different. And compassionate conservatism is not just a code word for conservatives becoming liberal. It's a different way of looking at things. It's an emphasis on the smaller groups, on community groups, on that type of personal interaction rather than bureaucracy. That's a conservative sense rather than a liberal sense. It's a sense of emphasizing liberty and emphasizing liberty for all people. And this gets back to the religious question then, including religious people, to have free speech, to participate in programs, to have full rights of citizenship.
Does that help,
that's
Debbie?
A real difference than what we've had in the past 40 years.
Debbie, does that help?
Well, I think we can do all that now. I don't see what's any different. I see there are a bunch of Republicans sitting around thinking, oh, my gosh, if you help people, it helps them. I mean, that's not a really big idea. I think that's an obvious idea. I think what we're focusing us on is all people who all of a sudden say that faith works, whatever you define
actually,
as faith.
Actually, there is a big idea here. You know, it used the old social service idea used to be that what caused people to be in need in society was large social forces, poverty, racism, structural unemployment, capitalism, and that what we really needed to do is to change these large structures and to talk to the poor in terms of values and beliefs was the wrong way to go about it, because what was happening to them was much larger than what was happening in their individual heart. Compassionate conservatism really rejects that idea quite powerfully. And whereas
where it gets pretty sticky for me. I mean, are you really saying that the problem in poverty is their values in poor people, that George Bush's values, I mean, I was young and irresponsible, should be teaching values now to poor people?
George Bush, by his own admission, up until 1986, had some real problems in values. He had some problems in his life. He went through a change.
Never interfered with his ability to, you know, pay the rent or live very, very well.
And there's a difference between rich people and poor people. Rich people have enough material to cover up sometimes the spiritual and psychological problems that they're having. You won't see the rich guy who's become an alcoholic out on the street drinking Mad Dog from a paper bag. I mean, he'll be in his own home, perhaps drinking scotch. There's a difference between rich and poor. The poor have no such they're the ones who really get messed up in this process in a very public way, and therefore that's why we have to come to grips with this spiritual problem that many among both poor and rich have, rather than just covering it over and thinking it's all material.
But can I just ask, does compassionate conservatism take it as a premise that the problem with poor people is that they have bad values?
Yes, it does.
Yeah, it is not a problem with poor people. It is a problem with many people.
Seem to have it worse.
Poor people do have it worse because they don't have any slack. We've had an enormous growth of single parenting in this society. A wealthy Hollywood actress can be a single mom and she'll have a nanny. A poor woman doesn't have that luxury. She's going to have it worse. She's not going to have any support system. She's not going to have a husband there. The kids aren't going to have a father. They're going to have it worse because they don't have any slack.
Wow, that's going to be hard news for a whole lot of people. I mean, your job is gone, or you're handicapped, or you're not organized, you're not represented in the union, you're underpaid, and it's because your values
are bad. Remember what I said before, that there are a lot of people who are poor because they get thrown out of work, they lose a job, or so forth. That's a lot of people, but there's also a huge number of people who are poor because of problems of values. Let's not go either to one extreme or the other, saying it's all values or it's all structural economics. I mean, there's often a mix of both. What we've tended to do over the past 40 years is look at man and woman as just material beings. We've tended to neglect the other side, which for many people is the biggest reason for poverty.
But Myron Magnet, you didn't hesitate to say that the first problem among poor people is their values.
You know, I think what I argue is that there has been a kind of revolution in values in America beginning in the 1960s, and that all those things that, if you're poor, will raise you into the middle class, and it got devalued, and all those things that if you're poor and do them will keep you poor forever got celebrated. So in the 60s, we came to celebrate sexual liberation, and if it feels good, do it, and the family is a kind of oppression, and you know, that drug use is exciting, that crime is a rebellion against an oppressive system. And these ideas were not located merely in poor communities. These were the ideas of the elite culture, broadcast through the universities, the elite media, even if you think of William Sloan Coffin back in those days, through the mainstream pulpits. Now, as Marvin says, when those ideas...
You know, William Sloan Coffin... I know William Sloan Coffin.
Yeah.
He's a friend of mine, and I'd never heard one hint of those words from him. I mean, you're talking caricature terms, but maybe when we come back, I'll ask, you know, Marvin Olasky to tell his own story, because Marvin went through the elite institution of Yale. He was a hardcore left winger, unbeliever, and I wonder if he felt he got those ideas from the culture. Did he get them from Yale? Did he get them from William Sloan Coffin? I mean, I think we have to pin down some of these charges. With respect, Myron Magnet, I'd just have to say that those sound like kind of very old caricatures out of the Reagan campaign, really, of what people might have been concluding. I never heard any of them advocated, but let's see. We'll be back after a short break. The phone is 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about compassionate conservatism with the gurus who invented it, Olasky and Magnet. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Addis Red Career Opportunities at Allaire.com.
This is the compassionate conservatism connection with Marvin Olasky and Myron Magnet. Marvin Olasky, you came to compassionate conservatism the hard way. I mean, you migrated through the culture of the late 60s and 70s to get there. Your story is a part of it. Do you want to sum it up?
Well, since you ask, I mean, I think Myron's exactly right in talking about the 60s and talking about William Sloan Coffin as well. I mean, I was bar mitzvah at 13, atheist at 14, and very proud and arrogant of my atheism. And when I went to Yale, it fed all that pride and arrogance and nourished it and grew it higher. I did go several times to hear William Sloan Coffin. I didn't hear any of the gospel in the church, even though he is a minister. He preached about Vietnam. He preached about what a wonderful generation all of us in the late 60s were, and how just using our own sense of creativity and pride, we could build a whole new America. This was like Charlie Reich, the greening of America. William Sloan Coffin was part of all that. So it just fed our arrogance. Just fed our sense that we knew better than any of our elders or anyone else. In my own case, and I don't blame Coffin for this or anyone else really at Yale, this was...
Well, you just did, but go ahead.
No, I'm saying for what's coming up. I mean, for my becoming a rather hardcore Marxist, I mean, that was me. Moving left generally, becoming a radical, that was Coffin and many of the other professors at Yale. But actually doing what I did becoming a communist, it was in at the time, but it wasn't actually Coffin pushing that. That was me, in my pride and arrogance, moving further in that direction. A lot of other people moved in that direction, but probably not as far. What changed me was coming to believe in God, because my communism was based on atheism, and once I came to believe that I wasn't the center of the world, that I wasn't this superior being who could run all things according to my laws, my ways, but actually there's a higher power who has laws and ways and principles that that we should follow. That changed my life and my way of thinking about myself and about politics and economics and everything else.
How old were you, just out of curiosity, when the new ideas sort of gelled?
Oh, 26, basically. I'm 50 now, so 24 years ago, 1976, that's when I actually became a Christian. And again, it had an effect not just on what I might do for an hour on Sunday, but it has an effect all through the week. And when we're talking about liberating religious people, I mean, that's the thing that that is essential here.
Hmm.
I'm a senior fellow of the Acton Institute for the Study of Religion and Liberty. And both those things, religion and liberty, are very important to me. They are often juxtaposed in American society. Gee, if we have more religion, we're going to have less liberty, but that's not the way it is at all. They do go together. Once we are able to live lives with integrity rather than just following whatever the political craze of the moment is, I mean, then we actually have liberty.
1-800-423-8255 joins the conversation with Marvin Olasky, who's in Austin, Texas, and Myron Magnet in New York City. Steve is on the line.
Yes, just a quick comment and then a question. The comment is that the view of history that we're hearing from the two originators of what you call compassionate conservatism seem to get most of their ideas from Reader's Digest. The ideas are so facile, such sound bites, with absolutely no meat attached to them. Those are my comments, and I think this program is really important so that you can see the sleight of hand that's being practiced on this government and on our people by people who claim to not want government and then are handed government by the Supreme Court. But that's just a comment. My question is, how does... Let me continue. My question is, how does a person who is bar mitzvahed at the age of 13, which is the time when one is bar mitzvahed, who is raised in a Jewish household, suddenly become arrogant, number one, arrogant enough to, as he said, become a Marxist and a communist? I'm assuming when you say communist that you weren't subscribing to Marxist ideas as much as you were actually carrying a card that said you were a member of the Communist Party, and then at the age of 26 saw the light, became a Christian, and this would normally be called schizophrenia in any other culture, but here it becomes a political doctrine. How can you justify the lack of inner centricity that you possess, and at the same time you're projecting it onto the country, assuming that you are the gurus of spirit and you're going to give it to the nation?
This is getting pretty personal, Steve. I want to give Marvin a chance to respond.
Well, again, number one, I think that all historians, all journalists, you do have to come to grips with your own history, but if that's all you're working on, then you're not very good as either an historian or a journalist. If the caller is judging the whole content of these ideas by what he hears in a few minutes on the radio, then he's not doing much of a service to himself. I've written three books on this subject. You might want to look at a book I wrote in 1992 called The Tragedy of American Compassion. You know, this is well footnoted. It is solid history, and that's essentially what I'm basing this on, rather than my own personal experience. But in America, we do like to get up close and personal. You know, in my own sense, I have a good friend, Rabbi Lappin, who's the head of an Orthodox Jewish group called Torah Tradition, and he points to bar mitzvah 13, atheist of 14, as the failure of what he calls liberal suburban Judaism. That may be. There could be a whole lot of explanations for that. I think it's a little different, that there is actually objectively a God who really is there. He's not a figment of our imagination. He created the world and he created us. And eventually we come to grips with him one way or the other. That's what happened in my case. Some people do it sooner, some people do it later. I'm grateful to God that 24 years ago, I was able to do that, and I've been, very consistent over the past 24 years, rather than schizophrenic.
Myron Magnet, it's your turn. If you
well, yes, I'd like to also say that name calling of the caller's kind is not particularly helpful there, and I'd like to address his charge of intellectual vacuity. I mean, like Marvin, I learned my intellectual arrogance at the same age, but I learned it at Columbia. And then I went away for 2 years and came back in 1968 when all my friends were under indictment for disorderly conduct and resisting arrest in the Columbia uprisings. And they were all persuaded that America, spelled with three Ks, was a fascist country and that there was a right-wing plot against them. And I remember when I came back, Bernadine Dorn of the Weathermen was commenting on the Manson murders. Oh, offing the pigs with their own knives and forks. Cool, the Weathermen dig Charles Manson. And I thought, these people are crazy. This is really not the political reality, and everything that I've kind of assumed as a sort of mild lefty cannot be right. And at that point, I thought I better read what the great thinkers have said about society and government. So I started with Hobbes and worked backward and forward. And, you know, Marvin takes his authority in Scripture and Revelation. I take mine in the great tradition. It seems to me that we've had thousands of years of people thinking about what is the right kind of life for man and what values conduce to a fulfilling life and a realization of all that man is capable of. So that what Marvin and I are saying is grounded in a long, long tradition of thinking about what a just society is and what the nature of the good man and the good citizen is who can make that society.
Marvin, stand by. There are callers that have been waiting. 1-800-423-8255 is the line. Jenna.
Hi, I'm a first-time caller. Thank you. And a clinical social worker who spent 15 years working in a housing project. And I am just staggered by what's being said. And let me just say one or two things about it. First of all, this is a lot of powerful men talking about poor women. It would seem to me that compassion would begin by asking women about their experience and what solutions they see is happening. Number two, it seems to me that where responsibility begins is not by yet again beating up on the weakest part of the population, but on taking responsibility for the parts of capitalism that are not working terribly well and that themselves lack compassion. The women I worked with would gladly go on to other lives if the doors in any way were opened, and it's just taken the government a long time to figure out how to do that, and the government is very inclined to be punitive instead of opening those doors, and what I hear today is more of that punitiveness. Finally, the idea is both naive and just, I don't know how else to characterize it, that somehow it's the ambivalence of social workers that keeps wife-beating going in the culture. If you know anything about world public health, and Arthur Kleinman at Harvard has written about this, wife-beating is one of the greatest public health problems in the world, and it actually is most prevalent in very conservative countries, where male hegemony is unconflicted. So these assumptions are quite amazing.
Jenna, thank you. Marvin, I'll ask you, do you want to respond?
Well, I mean, two things.
Here are people you haven't persuaded yet.
Oh, obviously. Two things. One, for those who want to be persuaded or just want to learn more about this, I do want to suggest another book. Myron Magnin has just edited a terrific book called What Makes Charity Work. It's a Century of Public and Private Philanthropy. It just came out. This is a terrific book full of case studies and examples in specific detail about what works and what doesn't work. But let me mention the whole thing about powerful men and poor women. I have learned more in researching this over the past 10 years from poor women than I've learned from any powerful men. The biggest indictment you see of the one-size-fits-all governmental welfare system comes from poor women. I've seen so many times where there are, let's say, a couple of poor women living right next to each other, and one of them is on crack, and her kids are running wild, and then the woman right next door, same socioeconomic group, same background in lots of ways, but perhaps because she has faith in God, perhaps for other reasons, she is very heroically fighting to keep her family together. When her kids come home from school, she sits them down and make sure they have some snack, make sure they do their homework. And then the kids from the woman next door are in there also. She's somehow stretching her extremely meager budget to be able to provide for them, and she's supervising them and making sure they do their homework too.
What's the moral for federal social policy?
The moral here is that governmental policy tends to treat those two women in exactly the same way. If they have the same socioeconomic background, they're going to get a certain stipend per month, they're going to be eligible for a certain amount of material help per month and so forth. I think a more humane and more successful program will find ways to get additional resources to that woman who's helping her own kids and her neighbor's kids, and will also try to find true help, real help, for that woman next door who's obviously suffering very badly.
Last caller is Lane.
Good morning.
Welcome, Lane.
My question, or my comment, my concern has to do with the fact that this compassionate conservatism strikes me as something that will invariably leave out gay and lesbian families. And our families are just as important and just as much need of compassion as anybody else's. But in general, conservatism.
Myron Magnet, what about gay and lesbian families?
Well, I mean, there's a sort of macro and a micro response to that. The macro approach is to say that it is important for. It is important for children growing up to be the kind of strong characters who can succeed in life, that they have strong two-parent families. And the danger with talking about how all families are equal and family composition doesn't have to be limited to what is pejoratively called the leave it to beaver mom and dad family. That it's presented as if the traditional two-parent family is just one other lifestyle, when in fact we now have mountains of research that show us that in every measurable way, two-parent, two-sex families are the best for bringing up sturdy children.
Listen, we'll be back on this subject, and thank you both enormously for joining us and walking us at least preliminarily around the block of compassionate conservatism. Marvin Olasky and Myron Magnet, thank you both, and thanks to the callers, too. Connection listeners, you can continue the conversation about compassionate conservatism on our website at theconnection.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and by the Allaire Corporation.